found at www.ael.uiuc.edu.
We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of the program, we'll be looking back to the life and work of a man who is widely considered one of the most important American writers of the 20th century. Certainly, he is the man who produced a book that is widely considered to be one of the most important novels of the 20th century. The man that we're talking about is Ralph Ellison, and the book is Invisible Man, a book that won him many awards, beginning with the National Book Award in 1953. It made him a national figure. By all accounts, though, he was not a particularly happy man, and was dogged throughout the rest of his life by his inability to produce a second novel. He also, in the minds of some people, particularly other younger African-American writers, remained was during his lifetime at least, a somewhat controversial figure. We will be talking this morning with the author of a recent biography of Ralph Ellison. The book is Ralph Ellison, A Biography. It's published by Knopf, and it came out just last month. Our guest is Arnold Rampersad. He is Sarah Hart Kimball Professor in the Humanities and also member of the Department of English at Stanford University. He has also authored biographies of Langston Hughes and Jackie Robinson. He collaborated with Arthur Ashe on his memoir, Days of Grace, and he has also written for a number of other publications, including the New York Times Book Review, The New Republic, and The Washington Post. Professor Rampersad, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
We appreciate it. I think that I'm expecting that there might be a lot of people who recognize the name of Ellison and recognize the title of the book as both being significant. I don't know. I know that the book has never been out of print. I'm not sure how widely read it is today. Perhaps it might be a good idea just to start, before we get too much into Ellison and his life, to talk a little bit about the book, about Invisible Man, and why it is that so many people consider it to be one of the most significant novels, at least, that were written in the 20th century.
Well, you're quite right that it has never been out of print, and I think it's still relatively well-known on university campuses in classes in English, so on. Well, the book is called Invisible Man, and it's written in the first person. It begins, "I am an invisible man," and that first person usage ties it to some of its kinfolk in American literature, Moby Dick, and you can go on Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and so on. But anyway, this is a story of a young black man who lives first in the South, where he experiences various forms of Jim Crow, and attends a Southern black college from which he is expelled because of his gullibility, comes north to New York, works in a factory, a paint factory for a while. There's an explosion. He goes on. He joins something called the Brotherhood, which seems awfully like the Communist Party. And a lot of the novel thereafter has to do with his life in New York, his attempt to work within the Brotherhood for forms of political progress, also involvement with black cultural nationalism, and it doesn't come to much good. In the end, there's a riot, he races away, he ends up in a hole, and there he is down in this hole. And in the epilogue, he talks about how he plans to come out from this particular room underground, a bizarre room, bizarrely designed room, a decorated room, because life is full of infinite possibilities. Basically, America is full of infinite possibilities. And, of course, the book that we have in front of us, he has written, since it's in the first person. So we realize that he has made art out of his extraordinary passage through life to that point. Ellison consciously wrote the book, tried to write the book at two levels. At one level, he wanted it to be a kind of story of a black everyman passing through some of the major cycles through which African Americans had passed, from Jim Crow in the South. There's even an echo of slavery to migration to the North, involvement in industrialization, involvement in political action, and also the lure of cultural nationalism, which he saw as leading really nowhere in particular. At another level, since he believed very deeply, profoundly in the liberal humanist tradition, what we call civilization and its values, he wanted to write a story about an everyman, on every person, if you like. And he wanted the story to operate on those two levels. And when the novel appeared, many of the reviewers commented on the fact that he seems to have achieved that double goal, that it is at once a story of a black and therefore, to some extent, limited and provincial, if you want. At another level, that this is a universal story about the individual and the search for identity and the search for authenticity and for purpose and for ideals to live by, and also how to resist the forces of what Ellison called chaos in the world. Chaos was a very, very important word for him. There was chaos on the one hand, and on the other hand, there was learning and reason and, civilization. And he very much feared chaos in America, in black America, in the world as a whole. And, of course, just to wind this up, the book appeared in 1952. The world was still very much under the shadow of World War II and also atomic warfare. It was the middle of the Cold War. There was a threat of nuclear attacks at any point. There was a sense of a potential catastrophic ending to the world. And in some respects, the way the novel ends with an explosion of violence and his disappearance into a hole and then his resurgence to create the book, and to some extent that reflected some themes that were very familiar and ideas and feelings very familiar to readers of all colors and creeds, as it were, around 1952.
Hmm. I want to go on and talk a little bit about some of the basic details of Ellison's life, but before that, a general point as you sketched out the plot of the novel. If you know at least just a little bit about Ellison, he grew up in Oklahoma, came from a poor family, lived in a small town. He went to Tuskegee, much like the character in the book, who then goes on to New York, which is what Ellison did himself. It would seem that in many ways, details from the book and perhaps some of the main themes, or at least aspects of this character in his life, do come from Ellison's life.
Well, I think that's correct. Ellison always resisted the idea that the book was autobiography, and of course it isn't autobiography at all, but he draws on what he knows very, very well. And one thing he knew, for example, was Jim Crow life in Oklahoma City. He worked as a waiter often in restaurants, in hotels and restaurants that catered mainly to prosperous whites, especially white businessmen, and there's a whole scene that clearly reflects his knowledge of that milieu, and then he went to the college, as you pointed out, in New York. When he got there in 1936, he worked in a paint factory. He got close to the Communist Party. Perhaps he was even a member of the Communist Party. He wrote for New Masses. He encountered black nationalism. He also reported on a riot for the New York Post, the 1943 Harlem riot. And he drew directly, almost on details from the riot that he had reported in constructing Invisible Man. I think that accounts for a lot of its power, and that is that he wanted to write a novel that was surrealistic at some levels and drew on his ideas about myth and symbol in the world, the power of myth and the power of symbol. But it's grounded on facts that he had lived through And I think that he can say it's all right for him to have said that it's not an autobiographical novel, but it is to some extent.
His father, Ellison's father, had this idea, or perhaps this hope, that his son would be a writer. He was in fact named after Ralph Waldo Emerson. His name was Ralph Waldo Ellison.
Yes.
He was interested in music, and in fact, when he went to Tuskegee, this was at the time when Tuskegee actually had a music program.
Yes.
So he went there and then when that program closed down, I think that was one of the reasons that he ended up leaving Tuskegee and going to New York. Where did this idea come from? This idea that his father had that he might be a writer, and how then though did he end up at least initially wanting to be a musician?
His father had hopes for him. His father died when Ralph was 3 years old, and it really was the catastrophic event of Ralph Ellison's life. And I don't think he ever really fully recovered from the loss of his father. I think all kinds of powers, but also all kinds of demons, were unleashed by the death of his father. It also plunged him into a poverty that he would not have known, a degree of poverty he would not have known if his father had remained alive to take care of the family. His mother simply could not get the kind of jobs his father would have had. It's why his father chose Ralph Waldo, we don't know, except that his father was clearly interested in literature and poetry at some point, and left behind an anthology of American poetry that became one of Ralph Ellison's most valued possessions. I think one thing that struck me when I was doing this research and asking myself the same question you posed, why did this fellow who was selling coal and ice in the streets of Oklahoma City in a wagon, why would he name his son after one of the most celebrated poets and writers of the United States, especially of New England in the middle of the 19th century, let's say, and a bit later on?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think one thing that I tried to keep in mind was the fact that for so many African-Americans in particular, they started out one way. They started out with hope, with belief in the country as a whole, belief in the literature of the country as a whole. And then there were, you're talking about 1900, 1890s, the imposition of Jim Crow by the Supreme Court across the United States. You're talking about the grinding down of people's hopes, so that although he is a peddler of coal and ice, and he's harboring dreams that were obviously powerful within him, put there by his family, put there by his school teachers, I'm talking about the father now, while he still looked upon the world as a place of infinite possibilities. Only later on does he, because of Jim Crow for the most part, I would say, only then does the calling your son Ralph Waldo Ellison become a sort of ironic, because it sets a bar that is very hard for a young black boy growing up in Oklahoma City ever to hope to clear at any point.
Mm. Well, given the fact, as you say, that his father died when he was very young and the family really had to struggle economically, how is it that Ellison even entertained the notion of going to college, and how did he actually manage to make that happen?
Well, within Oklahoma City, within the black community, there was a fairly rich life to which he belonged because his father put him there while his father was still alive. There were these connections. There was also a sense of community, so that by going to the Douglas Colored School, schools really, elementary and also high school, intermediate too, and so on. By going there, he stepped out of the world of being a poor black boy in Oklahoma City into a world where you had, grown-up people, teachers, principal of the school who was a Brown University graduate, people who looked out for the young people, who believed very much in the future and in the importance of insisting that that black young people, do not surrender, did not surrender to the ravages of Jim Crow, but kept on reading, learning, developing all their faculties to the utmost. In fact, it was one of these teachers who made him a musician, and that's what Ralph was from, when he was 6 or 7 until he was in his early 20s, until he left Tuskegee University. And that this business of being a musician not only brought him in contact with a grand tradition of world music, but also taught him discipline. And that discipline came in very handy when he became, when he decided that his true love was not music, but writing, literature. As for getting off to Tuskegee Institute, well, 2 years passed after high school, and because he had no money, he could not go anywhere to college. And then finally, he went off to college to Tuskegee because he was promised that if he would take charge of the band, play in the band as a trumpeter. He was always a leader in any orchestra he was ever involved in as a young person. That from this source would come enough money to keep him going at Tuskegee Institute. Well, when he got there, he discovered that the money didn't go nearly as far as he as promised him. But so it was a hard life, I would say, a tough life, but a determined life, as he to be a musician, dreamed of being a great composer. That was his real dream, until finally around 1936, when he is in his junior year at Tuskegee, he realizes that he probably will never become a great musician, and he becomes extraordinarily restless and leaves for New York City in the summer of 1936.
Perhaps I should just very quickly introduce again our guest for this hour, Focus 580, Arnold Rampersad. He is professor in the humanities at Stanford, a member of the Department of English, and is the author of a recently published biography of the writer Ralph Ellison. It's published by Knopf, and it's out now. It just came out last month. If you're interested, head down to the bookstore, the library, look for the book. Questions, too, are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. He, as you have explained, when he went to Tuskegee, he went to study music. He also, at that point, if not earlier, had spent a lot of time reading and was very much interested in literature. When he went to New York, he initially was interested in being an artist. The thing perhaps that set his life on the course that it would take for the rest of his life, though, was having met up with Richard Wright, who must have seen something in young Ralph that he thought this fellow had potential to be a writer. How did Ellison meet Richard Wright?
Well, first, on the second day, in an extraordinary piece of luck, on the second day in New York, in the lobby of the YMCA on 135th Street, a famous destination for many blacks coming to New York, he ran into Langston Hughes, and they began talking, and it was Hughes who first championed him, and it was Hughes, in fact, who wrote to Richard Wright, who was living in Chicago at the time, and said that there is this promising young man, young intellectual, in New York who would like to meet you. When you come to New York, I would like you to try and meet him. And that's how Wright and Ellison met. And Ellison, Wright was just about to really take off as a writer. He arrived in 37. In 38, he would publish Uncle Tom's Children, a collection of short stories that won prizes. But then in 2 years later, in 1940, he would publish Native Son, which would become a Book of the Month Club selection. It would sell at least 250,000 copies almost at once. It would catapult him to tremendous fame. Ralph had a gift for attaching himself to people who could help him. Could help him in substantial ways, not in temporary, frivolous ways. And he saw in Richard Wright something that he wanted for himself. The committed artist producing, publishing his art with a long-range plan, with a strong and sophisticated political sense, So Wright was a magnet that drew Ellison to him, and Wright reciprocated because once young Ralph Ellison began to speak, opened his mouth, as it were, people could tell that he was someone to reckon with, that he was a person of promise, that he was a serious person and an ethical person. And so the two men, their relationship grew stronger almost from the start.
When you think about Ellison, particularly at this time, and what he was thinking about, what he wanted to do, and who he wanted to be, and if he looked at Richard Wright as being a kind of a model, that is, that's the kind of person that he wanted to be, was it the case that Ellison was thinking about the work that he wanted to do, or it was more he was thinking about the person he wanted to be and the life that he wanted to lead? And did that somehow take precedence over the work? And one doesn't want to take anything away from Invisible Man or the essays, the nonfiction writing that he wrote. One wonders indeed where the focus really was. Was it in writing a certain kind of thing or doing a certain kind of work, or was it more in living a certain kind of life?
I think you've hit on something important, which is that what was driving Ralph from the start was a desire to be somebody, mm-hmm. to make a name for himself. He knew vaguely that he wanted to do it in the realm of art. He was smart enough to realize at a certain point, I'm a good musician, but I'll never be a great musician. He tried sculpture for a while, and then he decided he would be try to be a writer. But he never imagined himself as a writer of fiction in the beginning. In fact, it was Richard Wright who first said to him, would you write a review of a book for a magazine I'm about to edit? And Ellison said, well, I've never written anything for publication. And then Wright said, well, we'll start now. And then when that was in and then looked good, one day Wright said, why don't you try a short story? And Ellison said again, I've never written that. I have no ambitions in that regard. I can't write. And Wright said, we'll try. And although the story was not published in Ellison's lifetime, it was the beginning of his decision to try to be a writer. Richard Wright told him, it's too late. No great writer decides to be a writer in his 20s or her 20s and amounts to much. But he was underestimating Ellison's ability to drive himself to do things that other people thought he couldn't do. So that between, say, 1938 and the time he starts Invisible Man, 1945, you see the way just absolutely littered, almost is the word I want to use, with draft after draft, as he struggled to become both a world-class, or let me say a top-notch intellectual, and also struggled to become a first-class writer. For a while, what he wrote resembled a lot what Wright was writing, the kind of political protest, the gritty kind of realism of people like Dreiser and James T. Farrell and others. But by 1945, Ellison had found his voice. It was a sort of seven-year apprenticeship, a tough apprenticeship in learning how to be a writer and in finding his literary voice. But finally he did it because he had such a tremendous drive, which came, again, to go back to circle back to your point, which came out of a desire to amount to something in the world, to be somebody, to assert his identity in the face of a world that otherwise didn't care much for him. Hmm.
When did he begin, and how long did it take him to write Invisible Man?
He began writing Invisible Man in the summer of 45. I think he was writing a novel about a black man who thinks of himself as invisible earlier in the year. But the key thing for him, the breakthrough really, was when one summer day in Vermont on a farm where he was staying briefly, the words came to him, I am an invisible man. And suddenly he realized that this was the way he should tell the story, in the first person, not in the third person. And it also connected him to, as I said before, to Herman Melville, whose Moby Dick is all over the beginning of Invisible Man. It's sampled so very clearly. If you are familiar with Moby Dick, you see the words and situations involving Ishmael right there on the with Invisible's story. He also, as I said, was committed to surrealism and to ideas about the importance of myth and symbol in understanding history. And he began to work all those qualities, accept all those challenges in constructing his story. So he starts in 45. It's a long haul. Most people, I guess, who know him think, well, he's wasting his time. He's never going to produce much, and certainly not a great novel. And then he astonished everybody after revision after revision after revision, and aided by a few people, including a man named Stanley Edgar Hyman, a professor at Bennington, who was his close friend. And finally, around in 52, the novel appeared, and it was just a revelation to everyone.
Mm-hmm. He certainly had, he must have had an enormous ambition for this novel and perhaps for his writing overall, and that might be one of the answers to the question that I'm sure everyone asks you that you have to talk about a lot, that question being, why is it that he never completed a second novel? What was it, do you have some sense of what it was he believed that he was trying to achieve with that, with the book?
Well, I think I often counter when people ask me that question by saying, you know, the real question is not why did Ralph Ellison not produce a second novel, but how did he come to produce a first novel, mm-hmm. especially one as great as Invisible Man? How did he do that? But that having been said, you do have to return to the fact that the novel appeared in 1952, and he died in 1994. So you had this 42-year period in which there was no writer's block to speak of, even though he told Saul Bellow once he had a writer's block as big as the Ritz. But in fact, he was writing and writing and writing. He simply could not get into a shape coherent enough for him to submit it to a publisher and for his publisher, Random House, to accept. He couldn't finish the book. And you know, why couldn't he? Well, I guess there are layers of reasons, and one has to be pride and a certain degree of perfectionism that got out of hand. At some point in the biography, I say that he was not a good manager of his career. That if he had been blocked in the novel, found himself blocked in his inability to finish the novel, perhaps he should have written short stories. An autobiography, other collections of essays, because he did publish one very important collection of essays and interviews, Shadow and Act, in 1964. But I think finally you come down to the pride, excessive pride perhaps, that made him set standards for himself, but even his literary gods, and they included people like Faulkner and Hemingway, didn't set for themselves. I mean, I think both Faulkner and Hemingway, just to name two writers, I mean, I'm sure accepted the sense that their art was in decline after a certain high point, but they continued to publish. But for Ralph, that was not good enough. He had to produce over the top great art, or he would publish almost nothing at all. There are deeper reasons too. He was trying to write a story about the South, about a black hero, or well, two really, a black jazz musician who becomes a minister, an older man who has nurtured a young man who looks white and perhaps is white, but perhaps might be black, and who, after living in the black world, vanishes and then reemerges later on as a super racist New England senator, Adam Sunrader. This is a story, as Toni Morrison remarks in my biography that I mean, it has overtones of Faulkner, and to some extent, Ellison was you know, treating a theme that had already been treated, the idea of miscegenation, and perhaps you know, he was hemmed in by what others had achieved in this area, treating this particular theme. He was also, to make the last point, I think he was one of the points I make, or one of the propositions I put forward, is that he was working in a world within his novel, deeply steeped in the African-American cultural tradition or traditions, and yet still after, say, 1960, as he comes into his glory, he's not really living in that world anymore. And in fact, he is at some distance from it, in my opinion. And I believe that to some extent, you know, he was writing one way and living another way, and this separation, as it were, undermined his art. I think that is one. I may be wrong in my, you know, in the thesis, but that is one of the theses of my book, insofar as it has theses, that he wasn't living in the world he was writing about, and what he was writing about really was dated to some extent. As Toni Morrison wrote, told me, you know, Faulkner had done that kind of business as well as it can possibly be done, and Ellison was destined, I think, to be frustrated in his attempt to write a novel on that particular theme.
He won his book, Invisible Man, won the National Book Award in 1953, and that, as it is now, that is a very significant award. He won many others, and as I said back at the beginning, became a national figure, was asked to speak, was asked to teach. At the time that he won the award, he certainly was up against some stiff competition. I believe that same year, both Ernest Hemingway and John Steinbeck were in the running. And I think that you would suggest, perhaps other people would suggest, that this kind of success early on in one's writing career, with the very first novel, maybe it wasn't good for Ralph Ellison. Perhaps it might have been better if he didn't win that award, wasn't quite so lionized, because that, it seemed, in many ways, that seemed to be a distraction or a seduction for him that drew him into another kind of life, and that perhaps made that more important than his writing.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. He beat out Ernest Hemingway, Old Man of the Sea, and Steinbeck, East of Eden, in 1953, and that simply set off a firestorm, if that's the right word, of publicity. This is the year before the Supreme Court decision, 1954, begins to open all sorts of doors that had never been opened before. He is admitted to places that he would not have been admitted to before the Supreme Court decision, or before winning the National Book Award. He eventually will belong to the Century Club and to the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He would win two presidential medals. He would sit on all sorts of boards: the Kennedy Center Board, Colonial Williamsburg. He would just be taken up by the powers that be, and would be eager to be taken up. And yes, it was a tremendous distraction, because at a certain point, he was no longer really primarily an artist, as a kind of cultural figure, highly advertised, highly prestigious cultural figure, and the public, the world, seemed more concerned with what he symbolized than what he was producing. Had he not won that award, well, it's very hard to say what would have happened. But, I saw the applause dying down and almost silent. I mean, silence had stolen over the scene, and he was, I guess, in a place where he might have created a second novel. But then suddenly in January of 1953, you have this explosion of publicity. And while he takes it initially as as an incentive to produce a second great novel. He goes all back to Oklahoma City. He goes into the South. He's looking for inspiration. He's sure he's found, you know, the theme for the next novel and so on. He is distracted on every side, and to some extent it is a lesson about how you have to resist temptation. On the other hand, you know, he was in his late 30s, and he was not an immature person at that point. But I think one also has to remember what it must have been like for a black man to suddenly find himself spoken about in the most exalted way in terms of art and literature and culture and so on, and to be just suddenly thrust into the pantheon of major contemporary writers. I mean, Richard Wright had earned a lot of money and had attracted a lot of fame or notoriety from his native son and his autobiography, Black Boy, but no one thought of him as a major artist. Mm-hmm. Not at all. I mean, the novels seemed to be vehicles for protest more than for art. That is what distinguished Allison from Wright. I'm not saying that Wright was viewed accurately or fairly, but I'm just saying how he was viewed. Allison was seen as having beaten the best writers at their own game. And it's too bad, of course, that it was put in that sort of competitive term. But he was seen as a major artist, a constructor of fiction, of complicated fiction, and elevated in that way, you know, and praised, honored, and having, you know, fellowships offered and doors opened, opening everywhere. He became enormously distracted, and that I think was one of the reasons he never produced a second a masterpiece in his lifetime.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Arnold Rampersad is our guest. He's Sarah Hart Kimball, professor in the humanities and member of the Department of English at Stanford University, is the author of a newly published biography of the writer Ralph Ellison. It's published by Knopf, and it's out now in bookstore if you want to read it. Questions welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Ellison took great pride in being the first black man to go places where other blacks had not gone, and to travel in circles, artistic literary circles, where he was the only black man there. The criticism that has been made when he was still alive, certainly the criticism was made, but particularly by younger black writers, was that having done that, having gone through that door, so to speak, it was as if he slammed the door behind him. He didn't seem to want to mentor younger writers. He was uncomfortable with some of the political stands that they took. Why was that, do you think, the case?
Well, Ellison had very firm ideas about black America as a culture and also about America and about the world. He did not like the separatist aspects of the Black Power movement, and he resisted. He was also a very brave man. He was prepared to be unpopular, even though it hurt him deeply and reduced him at least once to tears. He did not like being rejected and reviled, but he believed in traditional African-American culture. He called it a very stern discipline in one place. He believed that blacks had created an extraordinary culture despite slavery, despite Jim Crow, and blacks had done so by clinging to virtues such as moderation, a kind of realistic look at the world, not a distraction by fantasies as he saw them about Africa, back to Africa and so on, or the Africa as a motherland. He did not believe in that one should segregate oneself and one's group into a corner. He also believed in America. Cornel West has called him a kind of an American super patriot, and I think that's fair enough. Ellison began, especially as as his ideas were challenged by Black Power and by separatists, to talk about the sacred documents of American life, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, Bill of Rights, and so on. He believed in the country. He believed that it was flawed, but at its core, it represented a triumph of world experience, a triumph of experience within the world, national experience. He preferred it to the cultural history of any other nation, and he thought that blacks should feel confident within that context, and with white allies should work towards the goal of a democratic, progressive society, and not one essentially based on apartness. For that reason, he was tremendously out of fashion with an awful lot of people in the 1960s. He was called an Uncle Tom to his face. His book was called Not a Black Book by at least one librarian I've recorded. As I said, it pained him. Although what is nice about his life is that by the end of it, he lived long enough to see a whole generation of younger black writers he had not helped, it is true, but a generation of major black writers who would themselves win prizes. I'm thinking of people like John Edgar Wideman and James Allen McPherson and so on, and Paul Marshall. A generation of younger writers see in his writing, in Invisible Man and in Shadow and Act, some of the finest ideals that they themselves wish to emulate. And in many respects, they were Ellisonians. So the very end of his life, although he never gave an inch, Ellison was never one to take one step backwards. At the very end, he had a sense of satisfaction and a sense of being at peace in some respects with younger blacks, and I think that meant a great deal to him. Hmm. As just before he died in 1994.
I believe, and you tell me if I got this wrong, that when you were working on your biography of Langston Hughes, you spent some time talking with Ralph Ellison.
That's true.
How did you find him? What was that experience like?
Well, I went there to his home on Riverside Drive, and he was unquestionably hostile to Langston Hughes, which really took my breath away, the degree to which he was angry at Langston Hughes, who had once helped him so much. But he believed that very early on, even while he was still good friends with Langston, that Hughes's art was almost beneath notice. It was too childish, that it was Hughes was too sentimental about black culture, this idea of celebrating my black culture, and I am the darker brother, and the Negro speaks of rivers, and that famous poem of A Raisin in the Sun, and all of these poems, What Happens to a Dream Deferred, these poems, which many people regarded as a tremendously significant body of art, and a source of pride and therapy for black Americans. Ellison didn't care for that kind of thing at all. He didn't see art as having that kind of function, and he thought art should be intellectual, complicated, a challenge, the way T.S. Eliot thought in The Wasteland, for example, that book-length poem, modernist classic, that art should not pander to the lowest common denominator, but be, as I said, complicated and extraordinarily, to use the word again, complex, as complex as the world itself is. He was hostile to Hughes. He was cold as a iced fish to me. It was a very, very uncomfortable experience being in his presence. One felt his rage. And this is something that, of course, a lot of people didn't see, but a lot of other people did see, which is that this man who had such authority and such fame, had such extraordinary recognition of the highest circles, in the highest circles, cultural circles, was also a man of anger, of rage that he governed. He subdued in that very stern discipline that he talked about as being part of the African-American historical cultural tradition. It was uncomfortable, and I never thought at that moment that I would ever be involved in writing his biography.
Well, a number of the reviews of this book, of the biography, make a point of saying that it's your personal feelings about Ellison come through. Your personal feelings, perhaps I don't know what sort of word one might use, disappointment perhaps about the turn that his life took, and particularly what happened in the years after all of the fame that came with Invisible Man. As a biographer, how do you think about that? Do you make an effort to keep personal feelings out of the project? Would you say that it's actually not possible to keep personal feelings out, and that's just going to be part of the work?
Well, you don't put your mind in a deep freezer because you are in a deep freezer because you are a biographer. I don't think I say anything about Ellison that isn't supported and doubly supported and triply supported by the evidence. I don't believe it's my right to suppress evidence about someone because it will diminish that person in the eyes of the reader. In fact, I'll say this. I think that my portrait of Ellison is eminently fair and even to some extent and loving. I was going to say sympathetic and loving. I think he the record is there out on the page in letters he writes to his wife, in letters he writes to other people that indicate that he was he was a complicated man, filled with a great amount of anger, and to some respects, justifiable anger. I say that what, in the end, we have to remember and prize is Ellison's art. Mm-hmm. Invisible Man, Shadow and Act, Going to the Territory, the three books he published in his lifetime. This is what is important. What the biography is, I think, in some respects, it is it's evidence about the price of great art. People love Moby Dick and they love The Great Gatsby and they love Farewell to Arms, and they don't think about the price that great art exacts. In the case of Hemingway, it was suicide. In the case of Fitzgerald, it was being drunken and an early death. Melville, it was also a paralysis of the spirit and great unhappiness. And then Ellison, again, Invisible Man didn't come cost-free to Ellison. Typically, great art exacts a terrible toll on the artist, on the spouse, usually the wife of the artist, on the children of the artist, on the people about the artist. And this is my attempt to write a mature biography about a significant American writer, a significant African-American writer. And I think that anyone who reads the book with sort of mature ideas about how history is to be told, life history is to be told, I don't think I have anything to be criticized for, in my opinion.
Well, I certainly, as you describe him, and as other people have described him, as you say, as a man who did have a lot of anger, a man who had been accused, perhaps justifiably, about using people and then casting them aside. He didn't treat his wife, Fanny, particularly well, and she was a very important support. He was a guy, apparently, who you didn't want to cross. It sounds like he would have been a very difficult man to like, personally.
Well, a lot of people liked him a whole lot. I mean, Arthur Schlesinger, for example, his clubmates of the century, or Louis Auchincloss, people like that, and others found him a very entertaining, strong man, a good man to have dinner with and lunch with, even though he tended to dominate conversation, especially after a couple martinis kind of thing. So there were people who liked him, there's no doubt about that. But there were an awful lot of people he shut out, and it was very hard for me, if I took Hughes as representative, for him to, for me to see him again, shut out not only people who had accomplished a great deal in the face of a lot of hardship, but also younger people who, and he had no obligation to help these younger black writers, but it was not a good time for a black writer to be selfish and still hope to be loved. And at a certain level, you know, Ralph believed that he had suffered, he had worked hard for what he achieved. Let others do the same. Don't bring any special claims to me about your suffering. America is a place where if you work hard, if you produce the art, you will be acknowledged and rewarded. That kind of tough, rugged individualism, expressed sometimes in a pretty bristling way, I mean, that was characteristic of him.
If you would like to read more, that is, I'm saying to people who are listening, if you'd like to read more about the life of Ralph Ellison, the book is Ralph Ellison, A Biography. It was just published last month by Knopf, by our guest Arnold Rampersad. He's also author of biographies of Langston Hughes and Jackie Robinson. He is Sarah Hart Kimball Professor in the Humanities and member of the Department of English at Stanford University. Professor Rampersad, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to WILL.UIUC.EDU. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
WILL programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe and Bevere Cafe 2 on the U of I campus. Bevere Cafe offers continental breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Tuesday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated and newly remodeled on the second floor of Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
It's 2 minutes before noon Central Time. I'm Celeste Quinn, and coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, our guest will be a cardiologist. His name is Barry Zaret. One out of five of us has cardiovascular disease, so how can we best treat it? How can we prevent it? We'll take up those questions this afternoon with Dr. Zaret. He is the co-author of a book that can help us on a sustainable program for heart health. The book is called Heart Care for Life. Let's take a look now at prices in Kansas City and in Chicago. July wheat, that contract trading at 620, up 7. September, 612, up 8. In Chicago, July wheat, 611, unchanged. September, 621 and a half, down 1/2. December, 635 and a half, up 1.5. July corn, 341, up 5. September, 348 and a quarter, up 5 1/4. December, 361 and a half, up 6. July beans, 904 and a half, up 13 1/2. August, 910, up 14. November, 937, up 14 1/4. July meal, 250 even, up 360. July oil, 37.65, up 10. At the Mercantile Exchange, August feeder cattle, 115.50, up 87 1/2. August live cattle, 93.25, up $1. October, 97.45, up 70.